Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday the 29th of July, these are our main stories. For the first time since 1997, when Hong Kong returned to Chinese rule, Beijing speaks out after weeks of protests in the territory. An investigation is underway in India after a woman who's accused a politician of rape was involved in a road collision. Also in this podcast, we'll be telling you why some call the 29th of July Earth Overshoot Day.
Within 210 days, we have used as much as Earth can renew in the entire year.
But first, evil and criminal acts committed by radical elements. That's how China's top office for handling Hong Kong affairs has described the long-running anti-government protests in the territory. On Saturday and Sunday, there were more violent demonstrations, pushing Beijing's Hong Kong and Macau office to hold a press briefing, its first since 1997, when Hong Kong returned to Chinese rule. Here's spokesman Yang Guang at the briefing.
The central government firmly supports the chief executive, Carrie Lam, in leading the Hong Kong government in law-based governance and firmly supports the police in strict law enforcement. Our special appreciation goes to the Hong Kong police and their families for the enormous pressure they have to bear.
Our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton, was at the news conference in Beijing.
This is the first time, apparently, that this office, this wing of the Chinese central government, has felt the need to go in front of the media and express its views about what's been going on in Hong Kong. It's incredible, really, because we went through the umbrella protests in 2014. This office stayed silent. This is the first time that they've really felt the need to put out their own viewpoints.
What about the tone of the conference? I mean, was there any suggestion of military intervention by Beijing?
No, that was the one question that the officials speaking at the press conference really seemed to want to shut down very, very quickly. They simply repeated a line that had been said by the Chinese Ministry of Defense almost a week ago, in which they said, look, just look up the relevant law. Now, the law that they're referring to is Article 14 of the Hong Kong Basic Law, which says that, yes, the Chinese military can intervene in times of natural disaster and social unrest. So still quite a vague law. The tone today was really interesting. It kind of oscillated between this really conciliatory attitude where they said repeatedly that they wanted to do more for Hong Kong. They wanted to ensure the economic development of Hong Kong. They even said that they noted that the youth in Hong Kong were upset because of a lack of affordable housing, a lack of jobs. However, then they would go to the other end of the spectrum and use really strong language, blaming radicals for inciting violence in the streets, blaming individuals in Western countries for helping to spur on this kind of violence and for showing sympathy to the protesters. So in the end, it seems that Beijing doesn't really know what it wants. It doesn't really seem to know how to handle these protests.
Celia Hatton in Beijing. Questions of foul play have been raised in India after a car crash left a young woman fighting for her life and killed two of her relatives in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh. The 19-year-old accused a senior ruling BJP party politician, Kuldeep Singh Sengar, of rape in 2017, an allegation he denies. With more, here's our South Asia regional editor, Jill McGivering.
It's really making headlines in India, and it's basically because the teenage girl in the car has become a very well-known figure since she made those rape allegations 2 years ago. She says the BJP politician assaulted her when she went to his office to ask about a job. He's always denied that story. But initially, she struggled to get anyone to take her case seriously. And in fact, it was only taken up by the authorities after she and her mother both tried to set fire to themselves outside the chief minister's residence. It was a form of public protest. That attracted a lot of media attention, and then it became quite a high-profile case. The politician has since been charged with rape. As I say, he denies that. He's been in prison for the past year awaiting trial.
And what's emerged about this crash?
Well, we know she was travelling on a fast road on Sunday. The car was hit by a lorry. The lorry's licence plate was apparently partially blacked out, and it's unclear why. But the driver has been arrested and he's been questioned. Also, she'd been provided with security officers to protect her. They weren't with her at the time, so there's some question about exactly why. Police are saying that their initial findings suggest it was just a road accident, simply, you know, pure and simple. But clearly there are members of the girl's family, there are some politicians with the opposition parties who are saying they suspect it may have been deliberate and connected to the rape case. So further investigations underway.
And two of her relatives have been killed in this crash, haven't they? And her father died as well.
Absolutely, also in suspicious circumstances. That was just days after the girl first highlighted her case. Her father died in police custody. He'd apparently been beaten. There is a separate legal case underway at the moment to try and find out exactly what happened in his case and if there was indeed foul play, who was responsible.
Our South Asia regional editor, Jill McGivering. On Sunday, the Nigerian government banned a minority Shia group after a spate of deadly clashes at protests in the capital Abuja, which were aimed at freeing its leader. Ibrahim El-Zakzaki, who founded the Islamic movement in Nigeria in the 1980s, has been in prison since 2015. He'd been due in court today for a bail application to seek medical treatment abroad, but it was adjourned until next week. His supporters say they'll not stop demonstrating until he's free. Our correspondent, Myeni Jones, has been speaking to some of them.
Ahmad was one of the protesters out on the streets on that day. We spoke to him later in the week in a local hospital. The lower half of his body was covered in bandages and he had blisters on his skin.
Policemen arrested me. When they arrested me, they continued beating me. I was brought here because I was unconscious. The last thing I could remember is that they poured something very cold on my body and it was very painful.
Sumaya is just 19 years old. She was also caught in last week's violence.
Security agents came out and started sporadic shooting from all angles, at boys and girls, men and women. As they were shooting, we were calling the name of Allah, Allahu Akbar. It was then that I felt them shoot me. I looked down and I told our people that they had shot me.
Despite the violent crackdown, small-scale symbolic protests have continued on a daily basis. Even on the day of prayer, Friday, police were stationed outside mosques in the country's capital. The authorities say this is an armed and dangerous group and have reacted very badly in the past to their gatherings. But the movement deny they have any intent of violence.
Using arms is haram.
Mohammed Ibrahim Gamawa is a businessman who's been a member of the Islamic movement in Nigeria for 30 years.
The Sunni Muslims are our brothers, the Christians are our brothers in humanity, and even non-believers are our brothers, so we don't have enemies, we don't use arms.
What would you say to those who say, why don't you stop? This is endangering the lives of your followers.
We will not stop coming out to push further our demands for justice.
Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria say they will stop coming out on the streets if their leader is freed. A federal high court in Abuja ordered the release of Ibrahim El-Zakzaki in 2016, but the state court in Kaduna in northern Nigeria, where Mr. Zakzaki has been held, has ignored the ruling. Professor Jibrin Ibrahim is a fellow at the Center for Democracy and Development.
There's a long history of friction between the Nigerian army in particular and the IMN, and they have a great sense of injustice against the Nigerian state because their position is hundreds of their members have been killed and nobody has been held responsible.
Where do you see the IMN moving, going forward?
Well, I have a great fear that if this crackdown continues, and if governmental authorities continue to send security agents to kill them, they are likely to be radicalized and may resort to procurement of arms. And if that happens, it will be a serious problem for Nigeria.
Nigerian authorities are already tackling the Boko Haram insurgency in the northeast, as well as an increase in kidnappings across the country. A sectarian war in the heart of Nigeria is something nobody wants.
Myeni Jones reporting. Still to come in this podcast, the BBC has seen evidence that Croatian police have been subjecting refugees to physical violence and are also sending them back to neighbouring Bosnia.
I met Croatian police. I met those guys.
You saw them here?
Yeah, I saw them. And I told them, guys, this is Bosnia.
And you said it's illegal to the Croatian police?
Yeah, I said.
What did they say to you?
They said they have orders to do it, and, you know, they are just ordinary policemen. And
so they have orders from superiors Croatia?
Yes.
We'll bring you that special report a little later in this podcast. Today, the 29th of July 2019, marks the date where we have exceeded Earth's ability to regenerate the resources being stripped from the planet. It's called Earth Overshoot Day, and it's getting earlier every single year. The newsroom's Tom Melville has more.
We're barely more than halfway through the year, and we've already used up all the resources our planet can generate in 12 months. That's according to the California-based Global Footprint Network. Mattis Wackernagel is their president.
Humans demand resources from nature, and then we can calculate how quickly nature can renew these resources again. And what we figured out using UN data sets is that within 210 days, we have used as much as Earth can renew in the entire year.
That renewal is the planet's ability to grow back the trees we've cut down, to reabsorb the carbon we've emitted into the atmosphere, and to regenerate soils that have been depleted. To live like we do, we need 1.75 Earths, say the GNF. Some countries are better than others. If everybody lived like they do in Indonesia, we'd make it into December before needing another Earth. But if we all had the same consumption as they do in the United States, we'd need 5. Scientists say that while the idea of Earth Overshoot Day is a useful visualization of just how much we're impacting the planet, the reality may be far worse than GNF estimates. For big parts of our world, data is patchy or non-existent. But the group's point is we can't go on like this forever, and we'll have to start living within our ecological means at some point, whether by disaster or by design.
Tom Melville. It's one of the richest countries in the world, but a new report out in Britain has found that more than 14 million people in the UK are living in poverty, about 22% of the population. Of that number, the investigation says around a third are living below the poverty line, defined as income below 60% of the UK average. The report comes from the Social Metrics Commission, an independent body that advises the government and is spearheaded by Baroness Philippa Stroud, who spoke to Update's Rebecca Kesby.
One of the things that surprised us is how little has changed over the last 20 years. So there are 14.3 million people in poverty at any one particular point in time, which is about a fifth of the population, which is extraordinary. But what's even more remarkable, it's actually been like that since our records began in 2001. And although there have been changes in the composition of who is poor, actually the number, the volume, hasn't really shifted. And then one of the things that we found particularly concerning is that 7 million of those have actually been in poverty year on, year out. And that to us was a really striking figure. And then even within that, 4.5 million are in deep poverty, 50% or more below the poverty line. And that is very entrenched and very stuck.
One of the things you looked at in this report as well was the spending of households. So that's things on childcare to go to work, also on rent, which is a big issue in this country at the moment, the cost of rent, and debt repayment, which I guess is part of the sort of cycle of poverty.
So historically, the poverty measure has only been capturing the incomes of a household. What's different about this measure is that it also captures the inescapable costs of that household. So if families, you've got both parents going out to work, there are childcare costs associated with that. So we include those costs. If, for instance, you have an adult or a child who is disabled, that adds to the costs of a household. So we have included included those as well. And obviously debt repayments, again, we have included these because these families have to pay these. This isn't like television or luxury goods. This is something that they absolutely have to pay. And this measure uniquely captures those.
In fact, I think your statistic is that half the people in poverty live in families where someone is disabled. That's an enormous figure.
Yeah. I mean, this was really striking to us when we first did this research. It's nearly half of those in poverty will either have a disabled adult in the household or a disabled child. But in a way, if you think that work and full-time work is so crucial, that really shouldn't surprise us, because if you have a disability, it's much harder to work full-time. Or if you are a parent of a child with a serious disability, are you convinced that the childcare that's on offer, if there is childcare on offer, which there often isn't for a disabled child, will actually genuinely look after your child's needs?
Or it could be more expensive childcare.
Much more expensive childcare.
The needs. And did you come up with any suggestions for the government as to how they can improve this situation? And obviously, many will know the British government has other concerns at the moment. But, I mean, what can be done to improve this situation?
So the Social Metrics Commission isn't a policy recommending body, it's a measurement body. But I think that the more you look at this broader measure of poverty, the more policy solutions kind of fall out of it in a way. So it is obvious that those with disabilities who are able to work need more support to be able to work. It is obvious that families with childcare needs, maybe if they've got two or more children, actually need probably better support in the childcare space. So the more you look at the way poverty is measured in this measurement, the more policy recommendations become evident.
Baroness Philippa Stroud speaking to Rebecca Kesby. A BBC investigation has found evidence of police forces in some European Union countries detaining refugees and migrants who've reached the continent, then expelling them to prevent asylum claims. An officer in the Croatian police says the expulsions are being carried out under official orders in defiance of international law. The BBC has also seen evidence that police, particularly in Croatia, are also subjecting refugees to beatings and physical violence, as well as stealing any money the refugees have. Our Europe correspondent Damian Grammaticus travelled to Bosnia and to Croatia.
It's a sweltering hot day. Washing themselves in a stream that runs through the green Bosnian countryside are a couple of dozen refugees. We're at Velika Kladuša, just across the border from Croatia, outside the external frontier of the European Union. These are people who fled their homes to find, when they entered the EU, not sanctuary, but violence, meted out by the very EU police forces they thought would protect them. Every morning, new groups who've tried to sneak into Croatia, been caught, beaten by police and dumped back across the frontier, come for treatment at a makeshift clinic. One man lifts his shirt to show purple bruises across his shoulder and back from Croatian police batons, fists and boots. Every single one says they were assaulted by Croatian police, then illegally expelled from EU territory. Even children like Mustafa from Egypt, who's 17.
When I go in Croatia, I say him, minor, don't hit me. They hit me more.
Once they're across the border and into the EU, the refugees should be given a fair hearing and due process. But in Croatia, and even if they make it to Slovenia, it doesn't happen. What appears to be a deliberate Croatian and Slovenian police policy to push people back and deny them their rights under international law to claim asylum once inside the EU. Surat Fazlic is the mayor of the Bosnian town of Bihać. He shows us along a forest path.
I met Croatian police. I met those guys.
You saw them here?
Yeah, I saw them. And I told them, guys, there is Bosnia.
And you said it's illegal to the Croatian police?
Yeah, I said.
What did they say to you?
They said they have orders to do it, and, you know, they are just ordinary policemen. And
so they have orders from superiors Croatia?
Yes.
On the same path, on footage captured by hidden cameras set up last winter, a Croatian policeman can be seen with a gun in his hand. He's leading refugees, men and women, out of the EU. We found one Croatian policeman who carried out pushbacks, willing to talk anonymously. His words are spoken by an actor.
I got orders from my superior. and he got it from his. It goes all the way up to the top. Later we realized it was wrong. We were told we have to catch them before they reach human rights groups or any place they would help them to seek asylum.
Croatia's government wouldn't answer our questions, but after we posed them, the country's president, Kolinda Grabar-Kitarović, visited the border, local TV cameras in tow, to say her police weren't violent.
It's normal people get bruises and injuries crossing this forest. Remember this when you hear stories about our police being brutal. They are not. I absolutely guarantee that.
And the refugees who are back in Bosnia denied their rights have endured other indignities too. The Croatian police who beat them also routinely destroy their phones, burn their possessions in front of them, and steal all their money. By some estimates, 20,000 have come this way in the past year and a half, abused by a Europe they thought would protect them. Those that don't slip through end up here, just outside the EU, penniless and hungry. The EU's welcome.
Our Europe correspondent, Damian Grammaticus. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
How do geckos walk up walls and across ceilings? How do beetles survive in one of the most arid places in the world? And how do humpback whales power their enormous bodies through the sea? I'm Patrick Ihe, and those are some of the questions I've been answering in my podcast, 30 Animals That Made Us Smarter. But the answers are actually just the beginning. The podcast is about biomimicry, solutions to human challenges that have been inspired by nature, like how the gecko's feet might help us grab hold of space debris, how beetles are teaching us better ways to collect water, and how the bumps on humpback whales' fins could make wind turbines more efficient. In every one of our short episodes, we look at a new animal and a new solution. There's lots for you to explore already and plenty more on the way. That's 30 Animals That Made Us Smarter from the BBC World Service. Just search for 30 Animals That Made Us Smarter wherever you get your podcasts.